In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, we hear from the current and incoming chairs of the National Governors Association, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, a Democrat, and Utah Governor Spencer Cox, a Republican. We'll talk about this week's NGA summer meeting and areas they say governors can work together on. Then Wall Street Journal Justice Department reporter Sadie Gurman discusses FBI Director Christopher Wray's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee this week. And a discussion of the political landscape in the upcoming battle for the Senate with Al Weaver, national political reporter for The Hill newspaper.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, a conversation with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, Democrat, outgoing chair of the National Governors Association, and Governor Spencer Cox of Utah, Republican, the incoming chair.
Governor Murphy, I'll start with you. You're joining us from Atlantic City, which is where the National Governors Association annual meeting is being hosted. Tell us about the importance, the role of the NGA in bringing governors together and the importance of meeting together.
I think the National Governors Association is the maybe last standing organization where we can find common ground across the aisle. And I've seen that both as vice chair to a Republican chair, Asa Hutchison, and now as chair with my friend Spencer Cox, vice chair, who's about to become chair in a couple of hours. I think it's incredibly important that we find common ground, and we've been able to do that. And this organization, that's been a hallmark of this organization, not just in our time here, but forever and always. And I'm optimistic that it will continue to be, and it will continue to be a role model, I hope, for civic discourse in our country going forward.
And Governor Murphy, as you said, you are about to pass the gavel to Governor Cox. What did you really focus on this year as chair, and what progress have you made on those initiatives?
Yeah, when you become the chair of this organization, you get an initiative, you raise money for that, you go around the country, and you hold convenings. And in my case, it was strengthening mental health among our youth. My wife had a companion initiative, which was infant and maternal health. And we learned a ton. We shared best practices. We acknowledged that we've got a challenge in each of those areas. But we also accept the fact that there is a playbook that governors from both sides of the aisle can use and apply to those challenges. And we presented those playbooks yesterday here in Atlantic City. And again, I'm an eternal optimist. I think we've made an enormous amount of progress. And
Governor,
why
the focus on youth mental health? Why did you choose that one particularly?
Well, I think you could make the argument 3.5 years ago, strengthening youth mental health was a noble initiative. You add to that a pandemic, and there's no question that our kids, all of us, but especially our kids, have suffered enormous stress over the past number of years, and that we know that we need to focus on this, whether it's money in our budget, whether it's training up folks more broadly to be able to cite and have awareness on the issue, whatever it might be. We all know that this is a challenge that exists. And again, I think we've delivered a playbook that has very tangible, very pragmatic steps that can be taken in any state in America to deal with it.
And Governor Cox, turning to you, your priority is going to be healthy conflict. Tell us about that, why you chose that, and what you're hoping to accomplish in this year.
Sure. Thank you. And let me just add to what Governor Murphy said. The work that they've done on youth mental health is so important to all of our states. And we're all very interested in this. We're learning from each other. We are the laboratories of democracy. And we're grateful for his leadership and First Lady Murphy's leadership on this critical issue. We are focusing on my wife and I, Abby, on this idea of healthy conflict and disagreeing better. I don't need to tell you right now in our country, we're seeing a very difficult, toxic divide. We're heading into what's likely to be the next most divisive election of our lifetime. And sadly, in many of our institutions and across this country, we've forgotten how to disagree the right way, how to debate, to persuade, how to help each other understand, again, where we're coming from, why we believe what we believe. This is not just another civility initiative. It's not just about being kind to each other, although we desperately need more of that. Our nation was founded on profound disagreement. Disagreement is important, but there's healthy disagreement and there's toxic disagreement. And unfortunately, we're seeing just so much toxic disagreement in our country. And I think, I truly believe that there's an exhausted majority out there. They're tired of the divisiveness. I believe that there's nothing more un-American than hating our fellow Americans. And we need to get back to those things that have really made our country special over the course of 200 and now almost 50 years.
And we were just talking with Governor Murphy about the impact on youth. So what do you think that this negativity in politics and the nastiness in politics how has that impacted young people?
Yeah, so over the past couple months, I visited 29 high schools in the state of Utah and had this conversation with tens of thousands of students. What I realized over the course of this time is if you were 12 years old in 2015, 2016, this is kind of all you know, right? You think this is what politics is in our country, that politics is about attacking other people and tearing other people down. It's not really about the issues. It's only tangentially about the issues. And that's very dangerous. I hear from young people all the time that they hate politics. They want nothing to do with it because of what they're seeing out there. And so I think we have a unique opportunity, especially to appeal to a younger generation who are tired of this, but I don't think it's just a younger generation. I think what we're seeing on social media talk radio and cable news, people are by and large tired of what they're seeing and looking for something better. We're hoping over the course of the next year that governors, who as Governor Murphy mentioned, we do work together on many of these issues, that governors can provide some counter programming to the negativity that we're seeing coming forward in the 2024 presidential election.
And Governor Murphy, regarding your partnership and your interaction at the national level, at the federal level, how are you seeing that? How is that going? And do Democratic governors necessarily need to be in lockstep with a Democratic president?
Well, I think we all I think we all have our party affiliations. There's no question about that. And I'm a big supporter of the president, so let me just say that unequivocally. But I also think we have our own independent realities, both politically and from a governing standpoint. And I think that's why, frankly, governors have never mattered more. It really matters right now in America who your governor is, where you live, where you work. And I could not endorse more strongly Governor Cox's initiative here. Enough already of the screaming at each other, us versus them. We know we have our principles. We know we have our passions. That's fine. That's the way it should be. We know we have our partisan affiliations. But let's find a way to civilly debate the issues that divide us and come to some kind of a resolution. As Governor Cox has said, this country was founded, and I'll use his words, on profound disagreement. We shouldn't shy away from that, but let's do it in the right way and not the wrong way.
And Governor Cox, on C-SPAN, we always air the state of the state addresses from governors around the country. How often is there agreement over the many states over really what the big issues are that you're grappling with? Or is it very regional or state specific?
No, look, I think, I mean, obviously there are some state-specific and regional differences. I used to believe, and this was kind of politics 101, that all politics is local. I don't believe that anymore. I believe that all politics is national. You can go to a city council meeting and hear people talking about things at the federal level that the city council has nothing to do with, right? And so I do believe that most of the biggest issues are national. And I think there is a lot of agreement about what those issues are. Certainly that's one of the benefits of the National Governors Association, is that we can learn from each other and work on those. The great thing about being a governor is that so much of what we do is actually not partisan, right? I mean, potholes and bridges are not partisan. So we actually have to get stuff done. Unlike Congress and some others, we have to do these things. And so we're not afraid to learn from each other. Now, there are partisan differences, and that's okay. That's important. But this is an opportunity for us to work on those. But I have to say this. One of the realizations and why I've chosen this initiative is that the biggest issues that we all agree on, you know, immigration and health care and energy policy, we actually can't solve any of those if we can't even have conversations with each other. If we're so busy hating each other and tearing each other down, we will never solve the biggest problems of the day. So I actually believe that this is an issue that kind of supersedes everything else. If we're ever going to solve those biggest issues that we all agree on, we're going to have to figure out how to disagree the right way to get there.
That was New Jersey Governor Democrat Phil Murphy, outgoing chairman of the National Governors Association, and the incoming chairman, Utah Governor Republican Spencer Cox. Next, Wall Street Journal Justice Department reporter Sadie Gurman discusses the key moments from FBI Director Christopher Wray's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee this week.
Here's your story today, and here's the headline. Wray pushes back a GOP against as its lawmakers assail the FBI. What was Director Wray walking into when he walked into this hearing yesterday?
It was his first hearing before this committee that has promised to conduct a far-reaching investigation of federal law enforcement and what its chairman, Jim Jordan, calls the weaponization of law enforcement and the FBI specifically. So, you know, he was bracing, I think, for a very combative hearing, and that certainly promised to be true. You know, we saw Republican lawmakers repeatedly interrupting him and just continuing to just give him this very aggressive grilling as part of his first oversight hearing since investigations of Trump, since Trump has been charged and since Hunter Biden took a plea deal.
As far as the term weaponization, how do Republicans apply it to the FBI?
Well, specifically, Republicans are saying that the FBI inappropriately is targeting their party and conservatives and trying to silence conservative voices and specifically supporters of Trump.
And what do they present as evidence of that?
Well, there were a number of different things. Yesterday, we covered a lot of ground. They talked about, in addition to the investigations of Trump and what they describe as a two-tiered justice system, more lenient handling of the president's son. We also saw things like social media. Republicans are saying that the FBI worked with Twitter and other companies to silence their voices and to take down conservative leaning thought off of the web. We saw criticism about anti-Catholic bias. We saw repeated attacks on the director about a memo from about 2 years ago concerning threats against school board members and the FBI's involvement in investigating those. So we really covered a panoply of different complaints and grievances from the GOP.
We'll show one of those exchanges in a bit, but in general, we heard the FBI director, give his defense of the Bureau. What's the main arguments he made to push back against these claims from Republicans?
He really did push back. He was very forceful, and he just strongly rejected any insinuation that the FBI is partisan or that it's acting on political motives. And he said, you know, since he's been in charge, he has tried repeatedly to instill this idea that you need to do things by the book. He's told agents, you know, you need to follow these processes. And he believes that they, for the most part, are doing that. You know, he has instituted reforms in light of some of the things that the Republicans brought up, and he just resisted any idea and any suggestion that the FBI is partisan.
I want to show you a little bit of the exchange that the director had with Harriet Hagerman, a Republican of Wyoming, about what you talked about as far as weaponization is concerned.
Yes.
Show you the exchange, and we'll get some context out of it.
Sure.
Mr. Ray, from the Twitter files, Missouri versus Biden disclosures, the Durham investigation and report, and exposure and collapse of the Russian collusion hoax, the American people fully understand that there is a two-tier justice system that has been weaponized to persecute people based on their political beliefs, and that you have personally worked to weaponize the FBI against conservatives. I asked Mr. Durham about this, to which he answered, "I don't think that things can go too much further with the view that law enforcement, particularly the FBI or Department of Justice, runs a two-tiered system of justice. The nation can't stand under those circumstances." Director Ray, what are you prepared to do to reform federal law enforcement in a manner which earns back the trust of the American people?
Well, first off, I would disagree with your characterization of the FBI and certainly your description of my own approach. The idea that I'm biased against conservatives seems somewhat insane to me, given my own personal background. As to how we are approaching our work of protecting the American people and upholding the Constitution, it starts with me having emphasized to all of our folks over and over and over again in everything we do that we need to do the right thing in the right way, and that means following the facts wherever they lead, no matter who likes it.
That was from yesterday. Now, Representative Hageman pointed directly at Chris Ray and said, "You're personally responsible for these kind of claims." What did she mean by that, or at least what do Republicans think she mean?
Well, they think that, you know, he is setting the tone as a leader of the organization, and that he hasn't done enough to keep to rein in his agents, in particular other leaders, you know, who they think are responsible for pursuing this sort of anti-conservative agenda. But what's really interesting, in addition to just the unusual political moment we're in, where the Law and Order Party is now some of the harshest critics of the FBI, and you see the Democrats really coming to the Bureau's defense. Additionally, Chris Ray is a registered Republican, and that was mentioned a couple of times. And so he resisted this idea that he is somehow anti-conservative because he's conservative himself.
And remind people how he became director of the FBI and who made that responsible.
Well, that's right. President Trump appointed him after firing former FBI Director Jim Comey. So this is Ray's a Trump appointee. He's been at the Bureau since 2017.
And so what happened in the transition between someone who was appointed by a Republican now to someone being vilified by Republicans?
Well, since then, we've seen the Justice Department aggressively investigating Trump. And also, we've seen the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And so these are two of just many different investigations that Republicans are pointing to suggest that the Bureau has been politicized or weaponized and is overzealously investigating Republicans and Trump supporters.
And to give some context to that, to the January 6th, when he was asked by several members about if FBI members were actually on present that day at the Capitol, can you give some context to that?
Sure. There still seems to be this idea that the FBI is strongly pushed back on, that they somehow had agents or, encouraging the violence, stoking the riot, and directing people into the Capitol that day. Many, many times the FBI, Chris Ray and other people, have pushed back on this idea, have said the idea that, you know, the FBI somehow insinuated, started the riot, is totally, unbelievable, and that this did not happen. But that's still something that's still a big Republican talking point.
And on the other front, when it came to the president's the seizure of documents from Mar-a-Lago and the FBI's role in that, offer some context there as well as far as the FBI's role.
Sure. So this is what they point to when they talk about a two-tiered justice system. They say that the FBI was overly aggressive in getting a search warrant to go into Mar-a-Lago and collect documents back in August. Especially when compared to the way that the Bureau and the Justice Department have been treating the classified documents found at President Biden's house. But there are stark differences in those cases, of course. The Justice Department says that Trump refused to relinquish the documents, and that's why they needed to go and get the search warrant to get them back. And in the case of President Biden, they say that he and his team quickly relinquished them and provided them and were cooperative. So, but still, Republicans are saying that this is a hands-off, kid gloves approach to Biden and a very aggressive tack toward Trump.
That was Wall Street Journal Justice Department reporter Sadie Gurman. Next, the Hill newspaper's national political reporter Al Weaver discusses his recent piece about the Senate seats most likely to flip in the upcoming election cycle.
Let me name those five seats: West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, Arizona, and Wisconsin. And the first thing you realize when you look at that list, no Republican currently sits in any of those five seats. Yeah. So what does that say about the Senate battlefield in 2024?
Well, I think right now what it says, the Republicans are, they have a unique opportunity to go on offense this cycle. I mean, they are playing ball in friendly territory in a bunch of red seats or red states. You have this West Virginia seat that they thought they should have won in 2018. Same thing in Montana. And then Ohio has only gotten redder over the years. So that they see prime opportunities in those seats for big pickups in a year where they think they should probably retake the majority. They thought they should have gotten it last cycle. The John Fetterman kind of thwarted them, and along with a host of Democratic incumbents, but they think this might be the year.
50-49-1 independent. That's the current makeup. Democrats having that razor-thin majority. Let's go to West Virginia. Joe Manchin, why is he at the top of this list of five seats most likely to flip?
Well, it's a couple of things. Unlike Tester, I think Manchin is a little bit more vulnerable this time around. First off, he hasn't even announced he's running for re-election. That's the number one thing. His numbers there are not fantastic. You look at most approval ratings, although I'm guessing they'll go up at some point. Right now, they're not doing too great, especially given his support for the name of the bill's escaping me from last year. But that's the main thing for Manchin right there. And he's also running against really good candidates out there. The governor, Jim Justice, is running for Republicans. He was one of the top recruits for them this cycle. He's in really good shape for there as long as he avoids this primary challenge, or not avoids it, but can sidestep it. So that they're feeling really good out there.
Discussion that Joe Manchin might run for president?
There's been some chatter, but...
Why he's holding off announcing a bid?
I don't think so. I think when you talk to people close to Manchin, what you hear is that they expect him to do this kind of like he did in 2018. 2018, he went up until the day before the filing deadline in January and announced that he was running again. And they expect something very similar this year. Manchin has said he'll make his decision probably in December. So that timeline lines up with that. And most people seem to think that he, no matter this flirtation with no labels and the third-party presidential bid, that he ultimately won't do it.
And then on the Republican side, Jim Justice and Alex Mooney, yeah, setting up a potential primary battle. Just run through kind of the state of the Republican race right now.
Sure. Well, the way you look at it is it's Justice's race to lose right now. Justice is... a very wealthy man. He was a two-term governor, extraordinarily popular out there. And he's running against Alex Mooney, the representative who previously of Maryland, now of West Virginia. He beat back an establishment election last year against McKinley in the redrawn district out in West Virginia. And he is no slouch in that regard. He has won tough races, and he's been underestimated for, and he's overcome that. So he's going to have to... the Club for Growth behind him, a conservative outside group.
Big money raiser.
Exactly. So he's going to have, if the club wants to spend money, he'll have it. But it's a matter of whether they want to at this point, because Justice is very formidable, and he is Republicans' top candidate in that state.
You said you put Joe Manchin just above John Tester on your list. So let's go to Big Sky Country.
Sure.
Go to Montana. Why is Tester right there?
Tester's right there because he's also in this type of state where Republicans think they have a massive advantage. They have a built-in advantage in the state, just that there are so many more Republicans than Democrats, and also that this is a presidential cycle. And no matter what some of these Democrats want to do, they are at the whims to a degree of the presidential year. You're going to have President Biden on the ballot in all likelihood next year against either former President Trump or potentially Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And it's going to be a big turnout driver for Republicans, no matter who's at the top of the ticket. Right now, Republicans are very excited that they got this Tim Sheehy into the race. Businessman, he's been there in the state for about a decade now. He was a decorated war veteran, and he's likely going to be running against Matt Rosendale, the congressman, a conservative rabble-rouser who made life difficult for Kevin McCarthy earlier this year. So we're going to see what happens that race. But Republicans feel good about Sheehy, and they think this might be the year they can finally beat Tester.
Montana, not a newly red state. John Tester, a three-term senator. How has he been able to win in a state that is usually more friendly to Republicans?
Well, like last time around, it was a couple of things. Number one is that he ran in 2018. It was not a bad year for Democrats by any means. Senate races were not as good as the House that year, but Tester still prevailed. He's a very strong candidate. He is more Montanan. That's the argument Democrats will make, that he is more Montanan than some of these other Republicans he's faced. You know, as I mentioned, he has not been in the state for too long, at least compared to someone like Tester, who's born and raised there. And so that's going to be the argument Democrats make, is that he is the right person for that state at the right time.
Before we get to some of the callers who want to talk the Senate battlefield in 2024, let me do one more.
Go for it.
Ohio,
yeah.
A state that is turning redder.
Mm-hmm.
Sherrod Brown trying to win re-election. He's number three on your list.
Absolutely. Sherrod Brown is another one in this Tester mold, in that he is very tough to beat. He's a Democrat incumbent who is a good fundraiser. He identifies with the state very well. That's the big thing Democrats are looking for this year. They have people on their ballots who represent their states very well. They talk about this with Manchin, they talk about it with Tester, and they talk about it with Brown. Brown is going to be a very tough out. This is probably going to be his toughest race, especially given the trend lines of Ohio. The last, he ran in 2018 and defeated a candidate who was not, Jim Renacci, was not a great candidate back then.
He won by 6 points back then in a state that Trump carried by 8 points in 2020.
Correct. And even look back to 2016 when Trump won big and Rob Portman won by double digits that year. So this state is going increasingly red. It's going to create problems for Brown. And if he wins, it's probably going to be by a narrow margin.
That was Al Weaver, national political reporter for The Hill newspaper. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.